So before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you're prepping for the Series 82, they've got a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and, you know, unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It's exactly what you need to pass. Check it out at certfuel.com. All right, let's get into it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so imagine you just executed this multi-million dollar trade for like your absolutely biggest client. You hit enter, the confirmation screens flash, and then your stomach just completely
Oh,
drops.
no, the typo.
Exactly. You made a typo. You bought when you definitely should have sold. And your first instinct is to just, you know, go into the system, hit backspace, fix the error, and pretend it never happened at all.
Right, which is human nature.
But depending on the exact electronic storage format your firm uses, you might actually be legally forbidden from deleting that mistake. Like it might be carved into digital stone forever, just waiting for a regulator to find it.
And they will find it.
Right. So today we are diving into the hidden machinery of Wall Street, the rules of what you have to write down, how long you actually have to keep it, and what happens when you say way too much at a dinner party.
My favorite topic.
We are conquering the books, records, and regulation FD section of the Series 82 exam. And listen, this isn't some minor footnote. This is function three. It is a massive 26% of your exam.
It is the absolute definition of make or break territory for a test taker.
Right.
Because people look at the phrase record retention and their eyes immediately glaze over.
Oh, 100%. You just picture like endless rows of gray filing cabinets in some dusty, windowless basement.
Exactly. But these rules aren't just, arbitrary bureaucracy designed to torture financial professionals. These records are the central nervous system of the entire global financial market.
The nervous system. I like that.
Yeah. Because without them, the SEC literally cannot track fraud. They can't prove insider trading. I mean, if these retention rules didn't exist, a corrupt executive could just legally tip off their wealthy buddies before a major market collapse.
And the buddies short the stock, make $1 billion, and walk away.
Right. And no one would ever be able to follow the paper trail. So the regulations we're unpacking today, they're the only things keeping the entire system accountable.
And because reading raw SEC statutes is basically a guaranteed cure for insomnia, we're not going to just read a list of rules to you today. To keep this grounded, we're going to use a recurring cast of characters.
Yes, we need to anchor these highly abstract legal concepts to actual human behavior.
So, listener, I want you to picture three people in your head. First, we have Riley. Riley the rep. He's a registered representative at a broker-dealer. He means well, he works hard, but he is fundamentally chaotic and, well, a little bit disorganized.
Which is realistic? The financial industry is kept running by thousands of Rileys. They're the frontline workers who occasionally need compliance officers to step in and save them from themselves.
Exactly. Then, sitting across the desk, we have Ingrid the investor. Ingrid is massively wealthy, fiercely independent, a natural person client. She has zero patience, operates totally on her own schedule, and views regulatory paperwork as like a personal insult to her time.
Which makes her the absolute perfect catalyst for examining how firms have to handle accounts that require constant high maintenance updates.
And finally, we have Sam the sponsor. Sam is a high-level executive at an issuer, a company whose stock is out there trading in the real world. Sam is charismatic, loves a good dinner party, and has a very dangerous habit of wanting to sound like the smartest guy in the room.
Meaning he tends to say way too much.
Right. So we are going to push Riley, Ingrid, and Sam through the regulatory ringer today. Let's start at the absolute ground floor, section one. Before we can even begin to figure out how long Riley's firm has to store a document, we have to understand what they are legally forced to create in the first place.
The creation rule.
Yeah. I look at this giant SEC list and it's just overwhelming. What are the absolute core records that a firm has to generate just to keep the lights on?
Well, the SEC's records creation rule is sprawling. It runs to more than 30 different highly specific categories. But for the Series 82, you really just need to lock down a specific core group that must be made and kept current. And the foundational document, the one everything else rests on, is the blotter.
Okay, blotter. Whenever I hear that word, I always think of it like a firm's daily diary. It's like, dear diary, here is exactly what happened to my money and my securities today. Is that the right way to think about it?
That is the perfect way to conceptualize it. A blotter is a record of original entry. It's the absolute ground truth of the day's activity. The SEC requires that a blotter contain an itemized daily record of every single purchase and sale of securities.
But it's not just trades, right?
No, it doesn't stop at trades. It has to include every receipt and delivery of securities down to the actual physical certificate numbers if they apply.
Mm-hmm.
It must track every receipt and disbursement of cash, all debits, all credits.
Wow.
Yeah, it is a microscopic second-by-second accounting of everything that moved in or out of that firm on that specific calendar day.
So Riley can't just type in, hey, I sold a bunch of tech stock for my clients today. It has to be granular.
Granular almost undersells it.
Mm-mm.
Each purchase or sale entry on that blotter has to explicitly show the account it was affected for. It needs the name and the exact amount of the securities. It needs the unit price, the aggregate price.
And the trade date, I'm assuming?
Exactly. The exact trade date. And crucially, it needs the designation of the counterparty, the person or entity the securities came from or went to. Because if regulators come in to investigate a suspicious string of trades, the blotter is the very first document they demand. It tells them exactly who did what, when, and with whom.
Okay, so the blotter is the daily diary of all the action. But, you know, diaries get messy. If I just want to see how much money the firm has overall or how Ingrid's specific account is doing, I wouldn't want to read through thousands of daily diary entries from a blotter.
Right, you'd be reading forever.
So that brings us to ledgers. We've got general ledgers and customer ledger accounts. Break those down for me.
Think of ledgers as the organized, categorized version of the blotter. The blotter is chronological. The ledgers are thematic. The general ledger reflects the firm's overarching macro financial health. It tracks total assets, total liabilities, income expenses, and capital accounts.
So if I want to know if the broker-dealer is fundamentally solvent, I look at the general ledger.
Precisely. The customer ledger, on the other hand, is the micro view. It's a completely separate, dedicated ledger account for each individual cash, margin, or other account. It takes all that chaotic daily data from the blotter and organizes it so you can see the specific purchases and sales just for one single account.
Wait, I feel like there's a linguistic trap hiding in there. It's called a customer ledger. If I'm taking the exam, my brain immediately thinks, okay, this is just for customers. This is just for Ingrid the investor. Let me ask you, does the firm have to keep a ledger for things that aren't customers?
This is a classic place where test writers will lay a snare for you. The name customer ledger is slightly misleading. I mean, it absolutely applies to every customer's account, but the rule explicitly requires this detailed ledger for the firm's own accounts as well.
Oh, wow.
And it requires them for the accounts of the firm's partners or executives.
Mm-hmm.
If Riley, the rep's boss, has a personal account at the firm, that account needs a ledger identical to the one maintained for Ingrid.
Because the regulators do not want firm insiders hiding their sketchy trading activity just because they aren't technically retail customers.
Exactly. They want eyes on everyone.
That makes total sense. Okay, moving down the creation list, we have trial balances and net capital computations. I know broker-dealers have really strict requirements about how much liquid cash they need to have on hand, their net capital, but how often do they have to actually do the math and prove it?
The frequency is the heavily testable component here. A firm must prepare proof of the money balances of all ledger accounts, alongside a computation of its aggregate indebtedness and net capital at least once a month.
Once a month?
Yes. The SEC doesn't let you just assume you're financially healthy. You have to run the hard numbers and create a record proving it every single month.
All right, now we get to order memoranda, or, you know, order tickets. And this is where things get philosophically interesting for me. Listener, I want you to picture this. Our chaotic rep, Riley, is having a terrible day. He finally gets Ingrid on the phone, and she screams at him to enter a massive buy order for a specific stock. Okay, the pressure is on.
Right. Riley scrambles, he types it all in, he hits submit, but he was just too slow. Right before the order can execute on the exchange, the closing bell rings. The market closes.
Oh, tough break.
The trade fails. It never happened. No money moved. No shares changed hands. So, listener, think about it for a second. If I'm Riley, my instinct is to just delete the pending order and try again tomorrow. Does Riley still need to make and keep a permanent record of that failed order?
He absolutely does. And this is a fundamental concept for anyone studying financial regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Order tickets or order memoranda must be kept whether the order was executed or not. Every single order entered into the system generates a creation requirement, completely regardless of its ultimate fate.
But I'm genuinely confused by that. If the trade didn't happen, why on earth would the SEC care? It's basically just a rough draft of a thought. Why clog up the servers with trades that never existed?
Because in the realm of financial regulation, intent is just as important as execution. Regulators aren't just looking for bad trades, they're looking for bad behavior.
Like what?
Consider a market manipulation tactic known as spoofing. A bad actor wants the price of a stock to go up, so they enter thousands of massive buy orders into the market. Other algorithms and traders see this massive demand and start buying the stock, which drives the price up.
Okay, yeah.
But the bad actor never actually intended to buy those shares. Right before their massive orders execute, they cancel all of them. They just created an illusion of demand.
Oh, so if the SEC rule only required records of executed trades,
that spoofer would be completely invisible. There would be no paper trail of their canceled orders. By forcing firms to keep memoranda of unexecuted and canceled orders, the regulators can reconstruct exactly what a trader was attempting to do.
That is fascinating. So the order ticket isn't just a receipt. It's like a psychological profile of what the rep was trying to accomplish. So what actually has to be on this ticket?
It requires a highly specific set of data points. The memorandum has to show the terms and conditions of the order. It needs the account name or designation. It must record the exact time the order was received, the time it was entered, and if applicable, the time it was executed or canceled.
And the price.
Yes, the price. And crucially, it needs the identity of the associated person, in this case, Riley, who entered it.
Let's add a wrinkle to this. Ingrid is wealthy and impatient. She decides she's going on a month-long yacht trip in the Mediterranean where she will have zero cell service. Before she leaves, she tells Riley, look, I trust you. Just trade whatever you think is best while I'm gone.
Ah, discretionary authority.
Right. She gives him discretionary authority. When Riley enters a trade for her while she's unreachable, does the order ticket look different?
It triggers an additional, very specific creation duty. If an order is entered under discretionary authority, meaning the rep chose the asset, the amount, or the action, without consulting the client on that specific trade, the memorandum itself must be explicitly designated as discretionary. There's usually a specific box or tag in the digital order entry system that must be checked.
Okay, but wait. Ingrid already signed a massive stack of paperwork giving him that power. The firm has a thick file folder with her written authorization in it. Why does Riley have to tag every single individual trade ticket?
Because regulators do not want to cross-reference a million individual trades against the central file cabinet just to figure out who made the decision. They want the order ticket to tell the whole story on its face. And this is important. You just highlighted a major trap for the Series 82.
Lay it on me.
Test takers often confuse the order ticket requirement with the account file requirement. The fact that the order ticket must be tagged discretionary is a completely separate records duty from the requirement to have a written trading authorization on file for the account. You cannot substitute one for the other. You need the signed authorization in the file, AND. You need the discretionary tag on the ticket.
All right, before we move on to how long we keep these things, I want to crystallize a huge conceptual hurdle for the exam. Making a record and preserving a record are two totally different regulatory functions.
They are distinct legal obligations governed by completely different subsections of the law. Creation is the act of bringing the record into existence. Preservation is the act of protecting it from destruction for a mandated period of time.
Right. I bring this up because the exam writers are ruthless. They will give you a question describing how long a record must be kept. They'll say, under SEC rules, which of the following records must be maintained for 6 years? And one of the answer choices will be a blotter. And a test taker will think, oh, blotter, we just learned that. That's the daily diary. That's the creation rule. And they get confused.
Yes. If the question is asking how long, it is testing the preservation side. The creation rule just says make it. The preservation rule says keep it.
Which brings us to the ecosystem surrounding these rules. We've been talking mostly about the SEC, but anyone in finance knows FINA is the regulator breathing down your neck on a daily basis. So if the SEC is demanding all these baseline records, where does FINRA fit into this ecosystem? Do they just copy the SEC's homework and say, yeah, do that?
Not at all. I like to think of it as an architectural relationship. The SEC pours the concrete foundation and builds the structural framing of the regulatory house. They set the baseline standards for the entire market. FINRA comes in, looks at that house, and decides it needs custom paint, specific interior decorating, and a highly sensitive proprietary alarm system.
So they add to it.
Exactly. FINRA has its own entirely separate family of record-keeping rules that go above and beyond the SEC's baseline.
What's an example of something FINRA cares about that the SEC Foundation didn't explicitly spell out in the same way?
Customer complaints are a prime example. FINRA rules mandate very specific retention and reporting requirements for written customer complaints that don't neatly align with just a basic SEC ledger rule. FINRA also has unique rules for things like authorizations for negotiable instruments, which we'll get into later. The point is, FINRA creates its own distinct list of things you must preserve.
Okay, so FINRA has this massive list of custom rules, but what if I'm taking the exam and I get a question about some obscure FINRA record? My mind goes completely blank. I cannot remember if it's a 3-year rule or a 4-year rule or what. Is there a lifeline here?
There is a lifeline, and it is the golden default rule of FINRA record keeping. Any FINRA book or record that does not have a specific retention period spelled out somewhere else in the rule book defaults to exactly 6 years.
6 years.
Yes, 6 years.
So if I'm totally guessing and the question specifically says it's a FINRA requirement, 6 years is the statistical best bet.
It's the safest harbor in a storm. If FINRA demands a record and doesn't explicitly tell you otherwise, keep it for 6 years. But, and this is where the relationship between the two regulators gets interesting, FINRA does not reinvent the wheel when it comes to technology.
What do you mean? If FINRA has its own retention periods, don't they demand their own tech setup? Like, do I have to buy a specific Finaro-approved hard drive to store their complaints?
No, and the industry is incredibly grateful for that. FINRA recognizes that forcing broker-dealers to maintain two completely different technological infrastructures, one for the SEC and one for FINRA, would be a total nightmare.
Oh, yeah. The IT costs alone.
Right. So FINRA's general record-keeping rule essentially routes back to the SEC's preservation rule when it comes to media and formatting standards. FINRA says, keep our specific records for 6 years, but you can do it using the exact same technology and formatting standards that the SEC already approved. They borrow the tech specs.
Okay, so we know what records we have to create. We know FINRA is layering their own demands on top. Now we have to talk about the clocks. Section 3, the actual timelines of preservation. How long do these files sit in a basement or on a server? And my instinct is to just, make a bunch of flashcards with a document on one side and a number of years on the back. Blotter, 6 years. Order ticket, 3 years. Is that enough to pass?
If you approach the exam that way, you will almost certainly fail the preservation questions. It is not a simple matching game. You cannot just memorize a list of numbers.
Yeah.
Because to truly understand and correctly answer these questions, you must view every preservation rule as a three-part equation. You need the retention period, the actual number of years, but you also desperately need the trigger, the specific event that starts the clock ticking. And finally, you need the accessibility requirement, how quickly you have to produce the record if a regulator walks through the door. Number, trigger, accessibility.
All right, listener, let's test that three-part equation. Let's start with the longest clock possible, forever, life of the enterprise. What kind of document is so important that the firm has to keep it until the end of time?
These are documents that represent the fundamental DNA of the firm. Articles of incorporation, minute books from the board of directors meetings, partnership articles, and the Form BD, which is the Uniform Application for Broker-Dealer Registration.
So, if the firm was a human being, this is its birth certificate, its social security card, and the medical records of its brain.
Precisely. And this applies even if the firm changes hands. If a massive conglomerate buys Riley's small broker-dealer, the successor firm inherits that DNA. They have to keep those original articles of incorporation for the continued life of the new enterprise.
Okay, so the retention period is life of enterprise. The trigger is the creation of the firm itself. What about the accessibility requirement? Do I need the firm's 1982 articles of incorporation sitting on my desk, ready to hand to an examiner in 30
This
seconds?
is a fantastic exam trap. The answer is no. There is absolutely no easy accessibility requirement for life of enterprise records. Regulators understand that you do not need the firm's founding charter for daily trading operations. They just have to be kept safely. They do not have to be easily accessible.
That's a huge distinction. Okay, let's move down to the 3-year clock. What falls into this bucket?
This bucket contains the bulk of your daily operational paperwork. Order tickets, the ones we discussed earlier, whether executed or unexecuted. Retained communications, like emails and letters regarding the firm's business. Most of your day-to-day transaction records that aren't the primary blotter.
Okay, and the equation for those.
For these standard operational records, the three-part equation is 3 years total retention, the clock triggers upon the creation of the record, and they must be easily accessible for the first 2 years.
Let's break down that accessibility rule. Easily accessible for the first 2 years. What does that look like in practice for Riley's firm?
It means for year one and year two, those records need to be readily available at the local office or immediately pullable from the primary digital server. If an SEC examiner walks in and asks for an order ticket from 18 months ago, you need to be able to hand it to them practically on the spot.
But then what happens in year three?
Once that ticket hits year three, the firm can move it to deep storage. It can go to an off-site warehouse or a compressed digital archive. You still have to keep it, but regulators give you more time to retrieve it if they ask for it during that third year.
That seems reasonable. But you said earlier that I can't just memorize 3 years because the triggers change. What's a 3-year record that doesn't trigger on creation?
Compliance and supervisory manuals are the perfect example. A broker-dealer is required to maintain written supervisory procedures, essentially the rule book for how the firm polices its own reps. The SEC says you have to keep these manuals for 3 years. But think about the logic. If a firm prints a great manual in 2020, and they use that exact same manual every day until 2030.
Ah, I see it. If the clock started on creation in 2020, the 3 years would expire in 2023. They would be legally allowed to throw away the manual they are currently using. That makes no sense.
Exactly. Which is why the trigger changes. For compliance manuals, the 3-year clock does not start when they are printed. The clock starts when the firm stops using them. When they replace the old manual with a new version, that termination of use is the trigger. You must keep the obsolete manual for 3 years after you retire it.
Because if a regulator is investigating something Riley did in 2028, they need to see the specific rules Riley was operating under in 2028, even if the investigation happens in 2031.
Exactly. The regulators need a time machine to see the firm's policies at the time of the infraction. And notice the accessibility requirement changes here too. Unlike order tickets, which only need to be easily accessible for the first 2 years, compliance manuals must be easily accessible for the entire 3-year retention period. The regulators want immediate access to your historical rule books.
Are there any other 3-year records with weird triggers?
Regulatory exam reports. When a regulator audits a firm, they issue a report. The firm must keep that report for 3 years. The trigger is the date of the report itself. And just like manuals, it must be easily accessible for the whole 3 years.
Okay, let's scale up to the heavy hitters. The 6-year clock. We already know the blotters, the general ledgers, and the customer ledgers live here. For those, it's 6 years from creation, first 2 years, easily accessible, pretty standard. But I want to bring Ingrid the investor back into this story because there is an ultimate 6-year side-by-side comparison that involves customer accounts. And I know this is a massive high-priority trap on the Series 82. Let's role-play this timeline out. I'll give you the scenario, you give me the regulatory reality.
Let's do it. Walk me through Ingrid's relationship with Riley's firm.
Okay, year zero. Ingrid walks into Riley's office. She decides to open a brokerage account. She sits down, signs a massive stack of account cards, agrees to the margin requirements, the arbitration clauses, the basic terms and conditions of the account. Let's fast forward 5 years. Ingrid has had enough of Riley's chaotic energy. She calls him up, yells at him, and officially closes the account. She takes her money elsewhere. How long does Riley's firm have to keep those original account cards she signed in year zero?
The regulatory rule for customer account cards, which established the terms and conditions of opening and maintaining the account, is 6 years from the account closing.
Okay, so she opened it in year zero, closed it in year five. The firm has to keep those original foundational account cards until year 11, 6 years after she walked away.
Correct. It is a trailing liability. Now, give me the second scenario.
Okay, parallel universe. Ingrid opens the account in year zero, but she loves Riley. She stays with him for a decade. But Ingrid is wealthy, which means her life changes constantly. In year one, she moves out of her penthouse and buys a sprawling mansion in the suburbs. She calls Riley and updates her address on file.
Okay, address update.
Then in year three, she sells a tech startup she founded and her net worth quadruples. She calls Riley and updates her income and net worth profile. These are updates to her customer account information. The account is still open, it's just evolving. What is the rule for the old, outdated information?
The rule for customer account information that gets superseded by an update is 6 years from the date it was updated, and it must be easily accessible for the whole period.
Stop right there. Listener, I want to make sure we are grasping the magnitude of this. Let's say Ingrid updates her address 5 different times over a 10-year period. Does the firm just shove all those old addresses in a file and wait for her to finally close the account before starting the 6-year clock?
Definitely not. And this is the trap. Each individual update triggers its own independent, isolated 6-year clock. If Ingrid changes her address today, the clock for the old address starts ticking today. It will expire exactly 6 years from now, completely, regardless of whether she keeps the account open for another 50 years.
So Riley's compliance department is essentially managing a cascade of overlapping 6-year clocks just for one client's basic life updates.
Yes, and you can see why the exam writers love this. They will construct a question that purposely blurs account cards with account information updates. They do this because both documents share that magical number, 6 years. But one triggers on the death of the account and the other triggers on the birth of the new information. If you don't know the trigger, knowing 6 years is completely useless.
That is devious. All right, I want to interrupt this flow with a scenario that sounds ridiculous, but I know there is a strict rule about it. Let's say Ingrid is off on her yacht again. The market takes a sudden violent downturn. Ingrid's portfolio gets crushed and she gets hit with a massive margin call.
Yeah.
She owes the firm cash immediately, or they're going to start liquidating her prized assets. Ingrid is out of sell range, but Riley remembers that Ingrid, in her chaotic confidence, left a signed blank check from her personal checking account in his desk drawer just in case of emergencies. Can Riley pull that check out right in the exact amount of the margin call and deposit it to save her account?
He absolutely cannot do that unless he wants to face severe regulatory sanctions. The SEC and FINRA have incredibly strict rules regarding negotiable instruments.
But she signed it. It's her check, and he's doing it to save her portfolio.
The regulators do not care about his good intentions. This is a severe conduct rule that ties directly into a retention rule. No broker-dealer and no associated person like Riley can take a check, a draft, or any other negotiable paper drawn on a customer's checking or savings account without the customer's express written authorization. You cannot just take their blank check and fill it out, even if you think you're saving them from a margin liquidation.
Okay, so how does Riley legally save her? Does Ingrid have to draft a formal legal contract before she leaves?
The authorization can take a couple of forms. It could be her signature on the fully completed check itself, meaning she filled out the amount and the payee before she left. That is standard. But if she wants to give Riley the power to fill out a blank check or draft funds on her behalf, she needs to provide a separate express written authorization document outlining exactly what he's allowed to do.
And since this is a deep dive on record retention, I assume that separate authorization document has a specific clock attached to it.
It does. If the authorization is a separate document from the check itself, the firm must keep that authorization on file for 3 years.
Triggered when?
Triggered from when the authorization expires. Not from when she wrote it, not from when Riley used the check, but from the moment that authorization is legally terminated or expires. And here is a nuanced, highly testable fact. Under this specific rule regarding the authorization, you do not actually have to keep the physical canceled checks themselves. You just have to retain the authorization document.
Okay, we've covered a massive amount of conceptual ground. We know we have 6 years of blotters, unexecuted order tickets that look like market manipulation, cascades of address updates, and margin call authorizations. Let's talk about the physical reality of this in Section 4. Are modern broker-dealers just renting airplane hangars and shoving literal tons of paper into dusty filing cabinets?
While there's probably a small ancient broker-dealer somewhere still doing that, the vast majority of the industry relies on electronic records. The volume of data generated by modern trading makes paper storage impossible. But regulators are inherently suspicious of digital files.
Why? Because they're easy to delete.
Exactly. If I make a fraudulent entry in a physical paper ledger and I want to cover it up, I have to use whiteout or rip the page out or burn the book. It leaves physical evidence of tampering. If I make a fraudulent entry in a basic Word document or an Excel spreadsheet, I can just hit backspace, change the number, and hit save. The evidence of my fraud vanishes instantly.
Yep.
Therefore, the SEC does not let you just save files to a standard desktop folder. They mandate two highly specific, technologically advanced methods for electronic preservation, and test takers need to be able to compare them directly in the ring.
All right, let's set up the heavyweight match. In this corner, the old school digital champion, Worm Format. Write once, read many. Explain the technology to me.
Worm Format is exactly what its acronym implies. The storage media is non-rewritable and non-erasable.
I always picture this as like a futuristic laser carving the record into a digital stone tablet. Once the laser burns the data into the worm drive, it is physically impossible to change it. If Riley accidentally types that he bought 1 million shares instead of 1,000 and hits enter, it is carved in stone.
That is a perfect visual. The hardware literally prevents alteration. It's the ultimate safeguard against digital tampering. But as you pointed out with the typo scenario, it creates a massive operational headache. Humans make mistakes. If Riley realizes his typo 5 seconds later, he cannot just edit the worm file. The file is locked forever.
So how does he fix it? Does the firm just have to live with a mathematically incorrect blotter?
No, the firm must enter a brand new separate correcting record that essentially says, ignore the previous entry, here's the actual trade. But think about this from the perspective of an SEC examiner. They come in and see a worm drive filled with millions of original entries and thousands of correcting entries. It's chaotic. It's hard to tell who is fixing typos and who is trying to obscure fraudulent trades by burying them in corrections.
Right.
Because of this inherent confusion, the SEC placed a massive, expensive burden on any firm that chooses to use the worm method.
What's the burden?
If a firm uses worm, they are legally required to maintain a completely separate audit system.
Defined separate.
It must be a standalone, independent system that provides total accountability regarding exactly who input every single original record and exactly who input every single subsequent correcting entry. And this separate audit system has its own retention requirements. It must be preserved for as long as the underlying worm records are kept.
Okay, so if worm is a digital stone tablet, the SEC is basically making the firm hire a separate guy to stand next to the tablet with a clipboard, writing down the name and timestamp of every person who touches the tablet. That sounds incredibly inefficient.
It is burdensome, which is why the SEC eventually allowed a modern challenger to enter the ring, the Audit Trail Alternative.
Okay, how does the Audit Trail Alternative work? How does it avoid the stone tablet problem?
This method relies on modern cryptographic and software engineering. It's a system that maintains a complete time-stamped audit trail, capturing the creation, modification, and deletion of every single record within the system itself. It meticulously logs the exact date, the exact time, down to the millisecond, and the unique user identity of the person taking the action.
So it's not carved in stone. I can hit backspace. I can edit the document.
You can edit it. But the system is so robustly engineered that it acts like a digital time machine. If an examiner suspects foul play, the system can magically recreate the original record exactly as it looked before you altered or deleted it.
Oh, wow. So if Riley realizes he made a terrible illegal trade in 2022 and he goes into the system today to delete it and cover his tracks, the system lets him delete it. But when the SEC shows up, the audit trail system says, "Hello, regulators. Riley deleted this file at 2.04 p.m. today, and here is a perfect cryptographic recreation of exactly what the file looked like at 2.03 p.m.
Precisely. It traps the bad actor by recording their attempt to cover their tracks. And because this immense tracking capability is hard-coded into the very DNA of the audit trail alternative, the regulatory burden shifts. If a firm uses this modern audit trail method, they do not need to maintain a separate audit system. The tracking is built in.
And there it is. Listener, if you are taking the Series 82, that is the core testable difference between the two systems. Worm requires a totally separate audit system. Audit Trail does not require a separate system because it acts as a time machine. But let me ask you, despite their differences, do these two systems share any baseline requirements, like things both of them have to do?
Yes. The SEC demands that whichever technological path a firm chooses, the sister itself must automatically verify the completeness and accuracy of its own storing processes. It has to self-check to make sure files aren't quietly corrupting. And, perhaps most importantly for an examiner, the system must be able to download and transfer a record and its audit trail in both a human-readable format and a reasonably usable electronic format at all times.
Wait, why both? If they have the electronic data, why do they need a human-readable version?
Because an SEC examiner doesn't want to be handed a USB drive full of raw, encrypted binary code or proprietary database files that require a specific, expensive software license just to open. When they ask for a record, they want the raw electronic data so their quantitative analysts can run algorithms on it. But they also want a simple PDF or text file that a human lawyer can actually read with their own eyeballs right there in the room. You have to provide both.
Okay, so the firm buys this expensive audit trail system. They are logging everything. But technology fails. Passwords get lost. Servers get locked out. The SEC knows this, which brings us to one of the more unique regulatory requirements, the undertaking. I've heard this described as a legal promise made to the regulators.
It is a legally binding commitment. Before a firm can rely on electronic storage, they must file an undertaking with their designated examining authority. In this undertaking, they promise to do three things if a regulator comes knocking. First, they promise to furnish the information promptly. Second, if the firm's internal IT department fails or refuses to download the records in both those formats we just talked about, the firm promises to have a mechanism to get it done anyway. And third, they promise to provide direct access to the system if the firm fails to provide the records and the regulator gives reasonable notice.
So it's essentially saying, we promise to cooperate, and if we physically can't or won't cooperate, we promise to let you in to get it yourselves. Now let's talk about liability, because I smell an exam trap here. Who actually signs this legal pinky swear?
The rule is very specific. It requires exactly one signature. But the firm has a choice of who that person is. It can be a designated executive officer, which means someone in senior management at the broker-dealer who has administrative access to the storage system. Or it can be a designated third party, an outside vendor or specialist who has independent access to the system and the technical ability to pull the records.
Okay, listener, let's run a hypothetical to test the boundaries of this. Riley's boss, the head of the firm, decides he will be the designated executive officer. He signs the undertaking. But he is a very busy guy, he travels a lot, and he doesn't want to be bothered by the SEC while he's on a golf trip. So he formally appoints three highly qualified backup designated specialists in the IT department. If the SEC calls while he's golfing, he tells them to talk to the backups. Because he appointed competent backups, does Riley's boss get to wash his hands of the legal liability if the backups fail to produce the records?
That is a masterclass in how test writers construct plausible distractors. The answer is absolutely not. The regulatory system requires backup redundancy, yes. But appointing a backup never, ever relieves the designated executive officer of their underlying personal obligation. When that boss signed his name on the undertaking, he tethered his regulatory fate to that system. The buck stops with him. If the backups fail, the boss is held responsible. He cannot delegate his ultimate liability.
The boss goes down with the digital ship. That is a great visual for the exam. Now, speaking of physical reality, where do all these records actually live? We know they're on servers, but does the location of the server or the physical access terminal matter?
It matters deeply to regulators because they conduct localized branch exams. The location rule states that the most recent 2 years of certain critical office-related records like the daily blotters, the order tickets, and the compliance manuals that relate to a specific branch office must be maintained physically at the office to which they relate.
So, if Riley works out of a massive branch office in downtown Chicago, the SEC expects to be able to walk into that Chicago office and instantly access the last 2 years of Chicago's specific blotters and tickets right there on site.
Exactly. The regulators don't want to be told, oh, you have to call our headquarters in New York and wait 3 weeks for them to mail you the files.
Mm-hmm.
However, the rule does provide a modernized alternative. The firm doesn't strictly have to host the server in the Chicago closet, so long as they can promise to produce the records promptly at that Chicago office or at another mutually agreed upon location the moment a regulator asks.
But what if Riley isn't in a massive downtown branch? What if Riley is working remotely? He's operating a home office out of his spare bedroom in Illinois. Does the SEC expect his spare bedroom to be a secure regulatory vault?
They make a pragmatic exception for home offices. If an associated person works out of their private residence, and crucially, they do not handle customer funds or securities there, and they do not hold that residence out to the public as a branch office, meaning there isn't a broker-dealer sign on their front lawn, those specific records do not have to be kept in the bedroom. They can be kept at another location.
Like a secure corporate storage facility?
Yes, but with one major geographical restriction, that alternative location must be within the same state as the home office.
So Riley cannot keep his Illinois home office records in a cheap storage unit down in Florida. They have to stay in Illinois jurisdiction. That is a highly specific, testable nuance.
All right, let's transition into section 5. What happens when the wheels fall off? Plot twists. Let's say Riley's firm makes a series of terrible bets. They run out of net capital. The partners throw their hands up, give up, and officially shut down the business entirely. They deregister as a broker dealer. The firm ceases to exist. I call this scenario the ghost of records past. It is one of the most misunderstood concepts by industry newcomers. When a firm stops transacting business, or officially deregisters, human nature assumes that the regulatory obligations die along with the company.
Right. If I close my restaurant, the health inspector stops coming. If the broker-dealer doesn't exist, they don't have to keep a 6-year blotter, right? They can fire up the shredders, sell the servers, and walk away.
Wrong. Deregistering or halting business does absolutely nothing to reset, shorten, or erase the retention clock on any record already in your possession. You do not get to fire up the shredder.
Wait, how does that work practically? If the firm is dead, who is paying the server costs?
The individuals who control the firm, the partners, the directors, the designated executives, they inherit the burden. If Riley's firm created a 6-year blotter on a Tuesday and officially closed up shop forever on a Wednesday, they are legally stuck holding on to and preserving that blotter for the next 5 years and 364 days. You must keep preserving whatever records you already had a duty to preserve for the exact remainder of their original retention period. The regulatory burden survives the death of the firm.
That is wild. The clocks keep ticking in the graveyard. I will never forget that visual. Okay, here's another plot twist that throws test takers for a loop. The Bank Secrecy Act bridge rule.
This rule is a source of immense anxiety for students because it references an entirely different body of federal law, but it's actually incredibly simple if you frame it correctly.
I always try to explain this rule using a highway analogy. Imagine you're driving down the SEC regulatory highway. You are reading all these rules about 3 years and 6 years. Suddenly you see a sign on the side of the road, but the sign doesn't have a speed limit on it. It doesn't list its own rules. The sign just has an arrow pointing to an entirely different highway, and it says, "Go comply with the Bank Secrecy Act." It is purely a directional pointer.
That is an incredibly accurate way to view it. The specific SEC rule regarding currency and foreign transactions record keeping does not create its own master list of documents to retain. It simply states that every registered broker-dealer must comply with the reporting and retention rules established by the Department of the Treasury under the Bank Secrecy Act, or the BSA.
Okay, but what happens when there is a collision between the highways? What happens when the SEC and the Bank Secrecy Act get into a jurisdictional fight? Let's say the SEC's preservation rule explicitly says, keep this specific customer transaction record for 3 years. But the Bank Secrecy Act's rulebook looks at that exact same record and says, no, this relates to anti-money laundering. Keep it for 5 years. Who wins?
Regulators never want to be accused of creating loopholes. So they create a universal tiebreaker. When the SEC rules and the BSA rules overlap and demand different retention periods for the exact same piece of paper or digital file, the longer period always controls. Always.
It's that simple. The longer period wins. 5-3.
It is that simple. The firm must comply with whichever rule forces them to keep the record longer. However, because this is the Series 82, the exam writers are going to try to lure you into a trap using this exact bridge rule.
Let's expose the trap. How do they weaponize this?
Because this SEC rule explicitly points to the Bank Secrecy Act, test writers know that your brain will immediately start associating it with anti-money laundering concepts. They know you've studied suspicious activity reports, or SARs. They know you've studied currency transaction reports, or CTRs. So they will give you a question asking about the SEC's BSA bridge rule, and they will ask, under this specific record-keeping rule, at what dollar threshold must a firm file a suspicious activity report?
Oh, I see it. They're baiting you to answer $5,000 because that's the standard SAR threshold.
Exactly. They put $5,000 as option A, and test takers jump on it. But it is a massive distractor. This specific bridge rule in the SEC rulebook sets zero financial thresholds. It does not dictate when to file a SAR. It is purely a pointer directing the firm to go follow the record-keeping retention rules of the BSA. If an answer choice starts talking about $5,000 SAR thresholds or $10,000 CPR thresholds in the context of this specific record-keeping bridge rule, it is a trick. Do not fall for it.
That is so deeply sneaky. I love breaking down the psychology of the exam writer. It makes the test feel like a game you can win rather than just a wall of text. Okay, let's pivot to some real drama, Section 6. We are going to bring Riley and Ingrid back to center stage. Let's talk about recruitment, account transfers, and the educational communication rule.
This is a highly tested area because it deals with the very real, very cutthroat world of broker recruitment. It deals with reps moving money.
Let's set the scene. Riley gets fed up with his firm. He's tired of the archaic worm drives. He's tired of his boss. A rival firm across town sees how much money Riley manages, and they want him. They offer him a massive signing bonus, a corner office, and a better payout grid. Riley accepts. He packs his desk in a cardboard box and leaves. Now, Riley is a businessman. He naturally wants to bring Ingrid the investor and her $50 million portfolio with him to his new home.
Which is standard industry practice. The regulators don't forbid reps from trying to bring their clients, but they do place a significant regulatory hurdle in front of the new firm that hired Riley.
What is the hurdle? What does the new firm have to do?
The new firm has an affirmative regulatory duty to deliver a highly specific FENHAN RA educational communication to Riley's former customers when they are contacted about transferring their assets to the new firm.
What exactly is this educational communication? Is it just a warning label?
It's essentially a standardized pamphlet created by FENHAN RA. It's designed to prompt the customer to ask critical questions before they blindly follow their rep to a new firm. It highlights important financial implications. For instance, it warns them that some of their assets might not be transferable and would have to be liquidated, potentially causing a massive tax hit. It warns them about transfer fees. It prompts them to compare the pricing structure and services of the new firm against the old firm. It's a consumer protection document.
Okay, so the new firm has to deliver this pamphlet to his former customers. How is that legally defined? Is it anyone Riley ever spoke to at the old firm? What if Riley just covered the phones for one day while another rep was sick and he executed one single trade for a random guy? Is that random guy Riley's former customer?
No. The regulators are precise here. A former customer is strictly defined as a customer who had an account assigned to Riley at his old firm. If he just filled in for a day or helped out on a joint ticket but wasn't the assigned rep of record, that person does not meet the definition. The new firm doesn't have to send them the pamphlet.
But Ingrid was definitely assigned to Riley. She was his biggest client, so she is undeniably a former customer.
Correct. So the new firm hires Riley. Now we need to discuss the timeline, because this duty does not last forever. It exists within a specific 3-month window.
Okay, I want to reason through this timeline out loud, exactly like a test taker would. Listener, think about this. Let's say Riley officially starts his employment at the new firm on Monday, January 1st. But he's a chaotic guy. He spends the first 2 weeks just getting his computer set up, figuring out the parking garage, and arguing with HR about his benefits. He doesn't actually pick up the phone and make his first contact with Ingrid until week 3 on January 21st. If I'm taking the test, my instinct is to assume that the 3-month delivery window starts the moment he actually contacts her, the moment the threat of the transfer begins. Is that correct?
Your instinct is logical, but legally, it is a huge exam trap. The 3-month delivery window is not measured from the date of first contact. The window is measured exclusively from the date Riley begins employment at the new firm, his official start date.
Wow, so the clock is ticking the second his ID badge is printed, regardless of whether he is actually dialing the phone.
Exactly. The 3-month window opens on January 1st. If Riley gets lazy or gets distracted and waits 3.5 months to finally call Ingrid, the regulatory window has officially closed. The rule no longer applies to that contact, and the new firm does not have to deliver the educational communication. The regulators essentially say, if you haven't tried to poach them in the first 90 days, the immediate threat of blind allegiance has passed.
That is a critical distinction, start date, not contact date. Okay, assuming Riley does call Ingrid within that 3-month window, we need to compare the delivery methods side by side, because the rule dictates exactly how and when the pamphlet must be delivered, and it changes entirely based on how Riley chooses to communicate with her.
Let's walk through the 3 distinct methods of contact. Method 1, written contact.
Riley sits at his new desk and types out an email to Ingrid. Hey Ingrid, I moved to a much better firm. Come with me. Let's move your $50 million.
If the contact is in written form, an email, a letter, a text message, the educational communication must physically or digitally accompany that written contact. You cannot send the email on Monday and the pamphlet on Wednesday. They must travel together. If it's email, ViandRye allows the firm to just include a direct hyperlink to the communication right there in the text.
Method 2, oral contact. Riley decides an email is too impersonal for his best client. He calls Ingrid on her cell phone while she is sunbathing on the deck of her yacht.
This scenario is vastly more complex from a compliance perspective. Obviously, Riley cannot beam a physical pamphlet through the phone lines. So the rule forces a 2-step process. First, Riley must tell her orally, right then and there on the live phone call, that an educational communication detailing important transfer considerations will be provided to her. He has to verbally warn her.
Does he have to read the whole pamphlet over the phone?
No, just a verbal notification that it exists and is coming. Then comes step 2. The new firm must actually deliver the communication to her within 3 business days of that phone call. They have a 72-hour grace period to get it in her hands.
But wait, Ingrid is incredibly impatient. What if Riley calls her, gives the verbal warning, and Ingrid says, I don't care about the pamphlet, I hate your old firm anyway, send me the transfer paperwork right this second so I can sign it on my phone. Does the firm still have 3 days to mail the pamphlet?
That is the exception to the 3-day rule. If a customer agrees to transfer immediately, the firm can just package the educational communication together with the formal account transfer approval documentation, as long as that documentation is sent sooner than the 3 business days. Method 3, the silent transfer. No individualized contact at all. Riley never calls her. He never emails her. But Ingrid, operating on her own chaotic schedule, finds out through the country club grapevine that Riley moved to a new firm. She decides she wants to move her money to him. She calls a new firm completely on her own initiative and initiates the transfer into an account assigned to Riley. What happens then? Even with 0 proactive contact from Riley, the duty still exists. If a former customer initiates a transfer into an account assigned to the newly hired rep during that critical 3-month window, the new firm must deliver the educational communication along with her account transfer approval documentation. The regulators want to ensure she sees the warnings before the transfer is finalized, regardless of whose idea it was.
Okay, I have a massive structural question about exclusions, because I know the regulatory world treats institutional money very differently than retail money. The rule explicitly states that institutions like massive corporations, banks, non-natural persons are excluded from being former customers. Mm-hmm. They don't need the educational pamphlet because they are sophisticated enough to know the risks. But look at Ingrid. She has a $50 million portfolio. She trades on margin. She is incredibly sophisticated. Doesn't she count as an institution?
This is one of the most brilliant trick questions the exam writers deploy. In many other areas of FINRA and SEC regulation, a customer with $50 million in total assets would absolutely trigger an institutional wealth exemption. But you have to read the exact text of this specific rule. For the educational communication rule, wealth does not matter. The only thing that matters is if the client has a heartbeat.
Wait, really?
Yes. The exclusion is carved out strictly for accounts of non-natural persons, or corporations, trusts, registered investment companies. Ingrid is a human being. She's a natural person. Wealthy natural persons are never excluded from this specific delivery rule. It does not matter if she's a billionaire. She still gets the consumer protection pamphlet.
I can see the exam question now. An individual retail client with $75 million in assets transfers her account to her former rep. Does the firm require the delivery of the educational communication? The instinct is to say no, she's too rich to need it. But the answer is yes, because she is a human.
Exactly. Do not let the dollar signs blind you to the definition of a natural person. Now, there's one more trap hidden in this rule. I call it the no thanks trap.
Set it up for me.
Riley calls Ingrid on day 30 of his employment, well within the three-month window. He tells her he moved. He gives the verbal warning that he's sending the pamphlet. But Ingrid is in a terrible mood. She says, "Riley, I looked up your new firm. I hate their research department. I am expressly rejecting this offer. I am not interested in transferring my assets. Do not send me anything. Leave me alone." She hangs up.
Does the firm still have to spend the postage to mail her the pamphlet within 3 business days?
The regulators are practical here. If a former customer expressly rejects the transfer on the phone, the duty to deliver the communication pauses. The CIRM does not have to force a consumer protection pamphlet on someone who just aggressively rejected the firm.
There's always a massive but in compliance.
But human beings are fickle. Let's say 2 weeks go by. We are now on day 44 of Riley's employment, still deep inside the three-month window. Ingrid gets into a screaming match with the manager at Riley's old firm. She gets so angry that she changes her mind, calls the new firm, and transfers her assets on her own.
Does the fact that she explicitly yelled no 2 weeks ago permanently exempt the new firm from the rule? Did her rejection kill the duty forever?
No. The delivery rule reactivates. If she transfers her assets inside that three-month window, even if it happens after a prior express rejection, the firm must deliver the communication along with the transfer documentation. The rejection only pauses the duty. It does not kill it. If the money moves inside 90 days, the pamphlet must be delivered.
That is a brilliant trap. Okay, we are rounding the final corner of this deep dive. Section 7, the big finale, Regulation FD, fair disclosure. For this, we are going to completely zoom out from Riley the rep. We are leaving the broker-dealer side of the industry. We are going to focus entirely on Sam the sponsor, our chatty executive at a publicly traded issuer.
This is a critical psychological pivot for the test taker. Up until this exact moment, every rule we've discussed has regulated Riley and his broker-dealer. Blotters, worm drives, pamphlets, that is all broker-dealer regulation. Regulation FD is entirely different. The very first thing you must establish in your mind is who is bound by this rule.
If I had a megaphone, I would shout this. This rule does not bind the broker-dealer.
Precisely. Regulation FD regulates the issuer. It regulates Sam. It dictates how companies that issue securities are allowed to talk to the public. It does not regulate Riley, the guy listening to Sam.
So if a test question describes an insider trading scenario and asks, under Reg FD, what action must the broker-dealer take?
The answer is almost certainly nothing, because Reg FD does not apply to the broker-dealer. The broker-dealer might be violating totally separate insider trading laws, but they cannot violate Reg FD because they are not the issuer. Sam is the regulated party here.
Let's break down exactly what triggers Sam's liability. We know Sam is a senior official at his company. He's at a lavish dinner party. The wine is flowing. Sam is sitting next to Riley, who happens to be invited. Sam leans over, acting on behalf of his company, and whispers some massive material non-public information MNPI to Riley. Sam says, hey, don't tell anyone, but our quarterly earnings next week are going to absolutely crush Wall Street's estimates. We made triple the profit.
That whisper is the exact trigger for Regulation FD. The rule activates when an issuer or a senior official acting on its behalf discloses MNPI to specific enumerated groups of people.
What are those specific groups? Because he didn't tell a journalist. He told a broker.
And that is exactly who the rule targets. The prohibited groups include broker-dealers like Riley, investment advisors, investment companies, or any holder of the issuer's securities where it is reasonably foreseeable that the holder will trade on that information. The SEC created Reg FD to stop issuers from treating Wall Street insiders like VIPs, giving them early access to market-moving data before the retail public gets to see it.
Let's test the boundaries of acting on behalf of the issuer. What if Sam is a perfectly compliant executive? He keeps his mouth shut at the dinner party. But Sam's low-level administrative assistant, who is absolutely not a senior official and has zero authority to speak for the company, sneaks into Sam's office at midnight. She steals the secret earnings report off his desk, takes a photo of it, and texts to her boyfriend who day trades. Does that trigger a Regulation FD nightmare for the issuer?
No, it does not. The rule contains a vital carve-out. An employee who discloses information in breach of a duty of trust or confidence is not considered to be acting on the issuer's behalf. Rogue employees committing corporate espionage or breaching trust do not trigger Sam's Reg FD duty. The company is a victim there, not a perpetrator. The duty triggers when Sam, or someone explicitly authorized to speak for the company, makes the selective disclosure.
Okay, back to the dinner party. Sam made the disclosure. He whispered the earnings secret to Riley. He just gave Riley a massive unfair advantage in the market. Reg FD is triggered. What must Sam do now to fix this?
The fix depends entirely on Sam's state of mind at the moment he whispered the secret. It comes down to timelines. And test takers need to compare these timelines directly because the exam writers will intentionally swap them to confuse you. We need to determine if Sam's disclosure was intentional or non-intentional.
Let's do intentional first. Sam is fully sober. He knows the earnings report is top secret MNPI. He leans over and whispers it to Riley on purpose, maybe hoping Riley will owe him a favor later or hoping Riley will start hyping up the stock. He did it deliberately.
If the selective disclosure is intentional, the rule is brutal. Sam, on behalf of the issuer, must make that exact same information public simultaneously.
Simultaneously? How is that even physically possible? If he whispers it at a dinner party, how does he simultaneously tell the world?
Practically, it means you cannot have the conversation at the dinner party at all. If an issuer plans to intentionally disclose MNPI to an analyst or a broker, they must release it to the broader public at the exact same moment. Usually, this is executed by filing a Form 8K with the SEC or issuing a massive press release or announcing it on a fully accessible public webcast. The key word to memorize for intentional disclosure is simultaneous.
Okay, but what if it's non-intentional? Let's say Sam isn't at a dinner party. He is giving a massive presentation to a room full of Wall Street analysts. He is reading directly from an SEC-approved script. But the lights are bright, he gets flustered, he accidentally turns two pages of his script at once, and he blabbers out the secret unreleased earnings number by pure accident. He immediately turns white as a ghost. He did not mean to do it.
If the disclosure is genuinely non-intentional, the regulators show a tiny bit of mercy regarding the timeline. Sam does not have to achieve the impossible standard of simultaneous disclosure. Instead, the issuer must make the information public promptly.
Promptly is one of those dangerous legal words that could mean anything. Does promptly mean Sam has 5 minutes to run to a computer and file an 8K? Does it mean he has a week? Let's deep dive into the exact mechanical definition of that word.
The SEC strictly and rigidly defines promptly for the purposes of Reg FD. It means the issuer must make the public disclosure as soon as reasonably practicable, but no later than 24 hours after the disclosure or the commencement of the next day's trading on the New York Stock Exchange. And here is the kicker. You get whichever timeline is later.
Whichever is later. Okay, listener, let's play with the math on that. Let's say Sam makes his accidental slip up during a Friday afternoon presentation at 4:00 p.m., right as the market closes for the weekend. So the 24-hour clock would technically expire at 4 p.m. on Saturday, but the market doesn't open until Monday morning.
Exactly. Because the rule grants you whichever is later, Sam has until the commencement of trading on Monday morning to file the 8K and make the disclosure public.
Yeah.
The SEC's primary goal isn't to force a panic filing on Saturday night when no one is trading. Their goal is to ensure the public has the information before the market opens and people can actually execute trades based on the leaked secret.
But let me ask you about the exact trigger point for that prompt clock. Let's say Sam accidentally says the secret number on stage, but he is so oblivious that he genuinely doesn't realize he said something wrong. He finishes his speech, goes back to his hotel, goes to sleep. 3 hours later, his general counsel, who is reviewing the tape, calls Sam in an absolute panic and says, "Sam, you just leaked the earnings." Does the 24-hour clock start the moment the words left Sam's mouth on stage, or the moment the general counsel called him?
This is a beautiful nuance. The clock does not start the moment the words leave his mouth. The prompt timeline begins when a senior official of the issuer knows, or is reckless in not knowing, that the information disclosed was both material and non-public. In your scenario, the clock starts when the general counsel realizes the mistake and informs Sam.
That is a mass of detail. It relies on the awareness of the senior officials. Okay, I need to clear the air on something that terrifies a lot of people studying this. Let's say Sam messes this up completely. He accidentally spills the beans, the general counsel tells him, but they mismanage the paperwork and they miss the 24-hour prompt deadline. They fail to file the Form 8K in time. Has Sam just committed massive, sweeping criminal securities fraud? Is he going to prison for manipulation?
No. And this is a vital distinction that the Series 82 exam will test. Missing a RegFD public disclosure deadline is a regulatory failure under RegFD. The issuer will likely be fined by the SEC. But the explicit text of the rule states that a RegFD failure is not, by itself, a violation of Rule 10b-5, which is a general anti-fraud rule against manipulative and deceptive devices.
So the SEC won't arrest him for fraud just because he missed an 8K deadline by an hour?
Right. They are separate legal exposures. If Sam intentionally leaked the data to his buddy so they could profit and split the money, that is fraud. But if Sam just accidentally missed the administrative deadline to file the public correction, that is just a RegFD violation. Do not assume every RegFD miss is automatically sweeping fraud, or you will get the exam question wrong.
Okay, last piece of the RegFD puzzle, the get out of RegFD free cards, the exclusions. Because it seems to me that companies have to share secrets all the time just to function. Not every single secret Sam shares can trigger a public 8K filing, right?
Correct. The SEC carved out specific safe harbors. For example, if Sam sits down with his corporate attorney or his investment banker and tells them the secret earnings data so they can prepare legal documents, RegFD is not triggered. Why? Because those professionals owe Sam and the company a fiduciary duty of trust and confidence. The SEC trusts that the lawyer isn't going to go day trade on the information.
Okay, but what about Riley? Let's say Sam's company is doing a massive private placement. They're trying to raise capital by selling unregistered securities to wealthy investors. They hire Riley's broker-dealer to act as a placement agent. Sam literally has to tell Riley all the company's financial secrets so Riley can understand the deal and sell it to Ingrid. How do they do that without triggering RegFD and being forced to broadcast the secrets to the whole world?
They utilize an express confidentiality agreement, an NDA. This is exactly why private placements almost always begin with a wall of NDAs. If Riley signs an express agreement legally binding him to keep the information confidential, Sam can tell him everything. Because Riley willingly accepted a duty to keep the secret, it is no longer considered an unrestricted selective disclosure. The regulatory shield is raised. RegFD is not triggered.
That connects the regulatory abstract to the actual real-world process. It's not just annoying paperwork. The NDA is a literal regulatory shield for the issuer. Okay, one more trap regarding exclusions. I read in the textbook that disclosures made in connection with the registered offerings are excluded from RegFD.
They generally are. If a company is doing a massive traditional IPO, the communications related to that registered offering have their own strict rules, so they are exempt from RegFD.
So if Sam's company is doing a Regulation D offering, he's safe, right? He can say what he wants because Reg D is an offering.
T-R-A-P. The exam writers love this exact setup. They will try to use a Regulation D offering as a distractor for an exclusion. But think about what Regulation D actually is.
Oh, wait. Reg D is an exemption from registration. It is an unregistered offering.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because Regulation D is an unregistered exempt offering, the registered offering exclusion for RegFD does not apply. You have to read every single word in the exam question. Regulation D does not equal registered.
That is so good. The test writers are evil geniuses. All right, we have covered a monumental amount of information today. From the daily diaries of blotters to the dinner party whispers of RegFD, we need to lock this in. I'm going to run a rapid fire recap. I will hit you with the concept and you give the listener the absolute top testable takeaway at lightning speed. Ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Concept one. Creation versus preservation.
Know the difference based on the phrasing of the question. Making a blotter is the creation rule. Keeping a blotter for 6 years is the preservation rule. Don't mix up what goes into a document with how long it lives in the basement.
Concept two, the FINRA default timeline.
If you are staring at a question about a FINRA record-keeping rule, and you have absolutely no idea what the specific retention period is, guess 6 years. It is the golden default.
Concept three, updates to customer account information. Ingrid changes her address.
Keep the old superseded address for 6 years from the date of the update. And crucially, it must be easily accessible for the entire 6 year period, not just the first 2 years.
Concept four, electronic formats, the worm versus audit trail fight.
Worm is the digital stone tablet. Because it is unchangeable and requires correcting entries, it legally requires a totally separate audit system to track who touches it. Audit trail is the time machine. Because it tracks changes inherently, it does not need a separate audit system.
Concept five, the Bank Secrecy Act bridge rule.
If the SEC and the BSA argue over how long to keep a specific record, the longer period always wins. And remember the trap. This rule is purely a pointer for retention. There are absolutely no dollar thresholds for suspicious activity reports buried in this specific rule.
Concept six, the educational communication window for a poached rep.
The three-month delivery window triggers on the registered person's hire date at the new firm, not the date they actually call the client. And remember, wealthy natural persons like Ingrid are still natural persons. They are not institutions. They still get the pamphlet.
Concept seven, RegFD and Sam the sponsor.
RegFD binds the issuer, not the broker-dealer receiving the tip. If the selective disclosure is intentional, the public release must be simultaneous. If it is non-intentional, the public release must be prompt, meaning 24 hours, or the next market open, whichever is later.
That is a flawless summary. Listener, if you can internalize those seven takeaways, you are going to absolutely dismantle Function 3 on the Series 82. But before we let you go hit the practice exams, we want to leave you with a broader philosophical question to mull over.
Right. If we step back and look at the trajectory of this industry, I mean, we just spent an hour talking about fixed 3 year and 6 year retention rules. We talked about designated executives signing paper promises to manually furnish data if a regulator asks for it. We talked of a 24 hour grace period for an accidental slip of the tongue.
Yeah.
But look at the technology being deployed today. We live in an era where an executive can unintentionally disclose material non-public information globally in a split second via a live social media stream. We live in an era where a broker dealer's digital audit trail tracks millions of micro edits in real time. So the question is, how long until these fixed concepts of years and days become totally obsolete?
That's a good point.
How long until the entire framework is replaced by continuous AI monitored real-time regulatory access, where the SEC's algorithms are directly plugged into Riley's trading terminal Tune 47? When you study these retention periods, are you learning the rules of the present, or are you just memorizing the final days of the past?
Man, that is a wild thought. Imagine an SEC artificial intelligence just having a permanent live feed into every broker-dealer's brain, instantly flagging spoofing before the market even closes. It would completely rewrite the exam. But, you know, until that sci-fi regulatory future actually arrives and the SEC changes the rule book, you still have to pass the exam in front of you.
You definitely do.
You still have to know the 6 year FANRA default, and you still have to calculate the 24-hour prompt clock. You got this. Keep hammering those cert fuel practice questions. Visualize Riley's chaos, Ingrid's impatience, and Sam's dinner parties when you get stuck, and go crush the Series 82. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.